This is KUOW's The Record. Welcome to it. I'm Bill Radke. This week, thousands of people are going to wait in line for hours outside Key Arena. They're not there to see a show or a game. They're there to get free medical, dental, and vision care. It is a giant free clinic that serves more than 4,000 people every year. The director of Seattle Center Productions, John Murner, says the patient's stories show why this pop-up clinic is needed.
They range from like a family in Spokane who saw this on the news, and they all piled in their van, drove over the mountains, and waited all night to get in line so the whole family could see the dentist. I had an experience last year where I heard a commotion at the front door, and I went, and there was a developmentally disabled gentleman who was trying to get in, but he couldn't quite understand the process and wasn't following it right. But he had a wound on his leg that was so extreme that they had kicked him out of the homeless shelter because they didn't know if he was safe. And we were able to get him in the clinic and take care of that wound and get him some medical documentation, what it was, so he could get back into the homeless shelter. And then we were able to get him a pair of shoes and socks. And he went away just as pleased as could be. And there was this moment where, was he going to get handcuffed or was he going to get in and get help? And we have social workers on site that step in and help people navigate this process, because it can be daunting, one, to wait in line for a very long time, and it can be challenging. So that's one example of a story.
So help me picture this enormous, crowded, basically pop-up clinic.
If you've been in the Key Arena before, you've seen the basketball floor, for instance. On the basketball floor, there's going to be 120 dental operatories doing a whole range of work with hundreds and hundreds of dental professionals down there just helping one person after another. All of the luxury suites, which many of us never get access to, are converted to exam rooms for doctors. And we've got women's health and foot care and wound care and HIV testing and a whole range of medical opportunities, including acupuncture and chiropractic in all of those suites. And then down in a lower area where we have better light control, we've got a whole vision lab where people can get full exams, get eye medical exams, get prescriptions, and then they choose a pair of frames, and we make them a pair of glasses and put them in the mail to them.
A listener might be thinking, wait a minute, don't we have Medicaid and we have indigent care clinics? Why is what you're doing necessary?
You know, no matter how you slice it, there are going to be people who fall through the cracks. We get a lot of people who come to this clinic, and we get a lot of information about our patients that they volunteer at registration. And we learn that many, many, if not like more than half of our patients have medical insurance, but they can't afford the copay or the deductible, or the minute that their doctor says, okay, I'm going to send you to the lab for these tests, they go home because they can't afford those tests and they're not covered. And so as much as there is a community in this area, in this state, trying to help people, there are thousands and thousands of people falling between the cracks. And an event like this that has a lot of visibility brings them out of those cracks, and they come down here and they get some help.
Is that part of why Seattle Center, Key Arena, a basketball floor works? Is it more than just space but also visibility?
The thing about Seattle Center is that we know how to produce a large-scale event. We also know how to make that event visible. That is our business. And so we've been able to partner with the medical community in Seattle to say, if Seattle Center takes care of everything, we're going to do the supply purchasing, we're going to do the volunteer outreach and the patient outreach, we're going to handle all of the legalities of this, including some of the malpractice insurance, all you have to do is walk in the door and do the art that you do in helping people. And so Seattle Center, as an event place, can create visibility and can create an organizational structure that they can just walk into and work. There was a dentist last year who said, you can't do more good in less time than in this place. And that's a situation we want to put these medical people in.
How can we make it so a clinic like this is unnecessary?
You know, that is our goal, to make this unnecessary. So last year, after the clinic, we did a task force that took a real look at who were the patients, why were they here, what were their needs, and to make recommendations. And now we've hired a PR firm to work with the clinic, with Seattle King County Public Health, to identify those issues that we need to solve as a community to make this unnecessary and communicate them more broadly to the citizenry so we can go about solving these problems more permanently.
And is there anything that gives you hope that we're getting there?
You know, the fact that the medical, dental, and vision community comes together for this event gives me a lot of hope. It says to me that there are thousands of people in this profession who want to help, and it has drawn so much attention because of its sheer scale that it has caused a conversation within King County, within the state of Washington, within the city of Seattle. And now, because of the clinic, all of those people are talking to each other. And so, yeah, that it does give me hope. It doesn't mean that it's not a big problem and it's not a big task, but it does give me hope that there are people working on it.
It's a huge task in money and time and people and traffic and just the enormity of it. Why is it so important for you personally to put this on every year?
The thing is, if you're down here at the clinic and you see these people who will wait all night in line, and you see that they're in pain, and you see that they have infection, and you see that they have no way to take care of that problem that they can find, it motivates you to go, okay, let's do this. And it's funny, my son said to me after last year's clinic, right after the clinic, we're pretty exhausted. There are four very, very long days. And he said, so are you going to do this again? And I said, I don't know, Sam. You know, this is really hard. And he said, so you're not going to do it because you're tired? And it was a really enlightening thing for me to say, there's no reason those of us who can shouldn't do this and continue to do it.
And John Murner is still doing it. He's director of production at Seattle Center, and he is, again, heading up the team that sets up the Seattle King County Clinic that opens on Thursday morning and goes through Sunday at Key Arena at Seattle Center. We're tweeting out a link with more information right now, so join us on Twitter at KUOW. And now let's talk about one of the efforts to put some money in people's pockets so they can afford health care. We are living in a state where we've got one of America's highest minimum wages, $9.47 an hour statewide. In Seattle, that minimum wage is higher. Should the whole state jump up to that? KUOW's Carolyn Adolph tells you about a state initiative that would gradually move Washington up to $13.50 an hour.
This is the latest in a movement that started in SeaTac, extended to Seattle, and now potentially goes statewide. Labor supports it, the governor gathered signatures for it, and a venture capitalist, Nick Hanauer, is its major donor. Who's against it?
I'm not actively out campaigning against it, but I don't think it's a good idea.
This is Mike Condon, owner of Mike's Community Cup. It's a coffee shop in SeaTac. The original SeaTac minimum wage applied to big businesses around the airport, the hotels and the shops inside the terminals. Condon's coffee shop wasn't supposed to be affected, but
it did affect our business.
Condon says when wages went up at the airport, small businesses quickly learned that they had to compete if they wanted workers.
You know, and we ended up having to increase our wages.
Condon says the $15 minimum wage did not bring more customers to his coffee shop. He says he's not against an initiative that would raise the minimum wage in the entire state. However,
I think it would be a good idea if it excluded small businesses less than 20 employees.
Initiative 1433 does not exclude small businesses, and it also provides paid sick leave, just as Seattle recently decided. The 1433 package is opposed by the state's Farm Bureau and its restaurant, food industry, and retail associations, businesses directly affected by the cost of low-paid labor. But the no side's contributions are well under the $3.5 million put in by the yes side. A half dozen unions and labor councils are backing the initiative.
And the hope is that with the passage of 1433, that there'll start to be stronger wages all over the state.
This is Nicole Grant, executive secretary of the Martin Luther King Labor Council.
We have a situation today where, because Seattle has a higher minimum wage, that people who live in places like Federal Way find themselves with these very long commutes.
That can cost real money and take time away from family. Grant says, wouldn't it be better to
be able to work in that community and make a wage that, you know, makes it possible to avoid the insane commute?
Even if 1433 passes, there would still be a gap of around $3 an hour between the Seattle minimum wage and the rest of the state. Without the initiative, the gap would be more like $5 or $6 an hour. I'm Carolyn Adolph, KUOW News.
Hey, it's KOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in for some big ideas now. More police. That's one of the items in Seattle Mayor Ed Murray's latest budget. But some activists want the opposite. They want the city to defund the police. Seattle attorney Nikita Oliver is an anti-racism activist. She says defunding the Seattle Police Department is just the first step to a culture that doesn't need police at all.
One, I think we need a cultural shift in how we think about peace and how we think about how people, about our own individual sovereignty as humans, but also how we all control our own behavior. As a teacher in a classroom, I can do everything I want to police the behavior of my students, but reality is they control themselves. I think society is constructed in a lot of the same ways, that we don't need a separate institution to keep the peace or enforce the laws. What we need is a cultural shift that actually acknowledges the human rights, dignity, and sovereignty of all people. And we'd see a lot of the crimes that we use to justify the police decrease, or the reasons that we say we need police to keep peace.
What's a crime that would go away?
I think drug crimes could go away, which would require some decriminalization. We have a lot of crimes that we have criminalized as a means of social control. So we say we don't like it when drug addicts use in public. So then what we do is we create laws against drug use. Instead of creating something like a safe injection site where folks who do choose to use drugs or maybe are dealing with addiction can go to that safe injection site.
And we are changing our drug laws in many places, including Washington. But what do you say to somebody who's the victim of a rape, a murder, a home invasion who says that's what the police are for?
Yeah, so looking at our statistics from 2016, there have been 124 rapes in 2016 in our county. And so of the 30,972 calls that have been made, 124 were rapes. That percentage is incredibly small. And so it's not to say that we won't need some sort of mechanism for addressing crimes of harm, but there are other mechanisms that we know of globally, worldwide, that can be used to address that, to be more restorative and to be less punitive.
What are those methods?
Restorative justice is community-based accountability. It's the idea that anytime an issue happens, the community as a whole is actually responsible for that issue happening. It's not just quote-unquote perpetrator, offender, and victim. It's everyone within the community played a role in that particular outcome. And so what restorative justice hopes to do is to look at everyone involved and ask ourselves, what can we do to restore ourselves back to a healthy, balanced, functioning community? And in the instance of rape, there are so many reasons why it occurs. And the goal of restorative justice is not simply to deal with that one instance, but it's to also ask ourselves what other factors were surrounding that rape that made it possible. How do we begin to alleviate and eliminate those factors so rape slowly becomes and we don't deal with anymore?
What about saying maybe restorative justice is the vision for the future, but today we still need police?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that I'm going to walk out of KOW today and all of a sudden we're going to be able to fully dismantle the policing institution. I mean, it's been in play for a long time. I think what has to happen is we need the goal of the cultural shift that allows us to dismantle the policing institution. There are a lot of people in power who feel safe with the police. So even considering that there are marginalized or grassroots organizers or communities that don't consider police safe is so far outside of their paradigm that they can't imagine it. So how do you then get a whole group of people who see the policing institution as keeping them safe to acknowledge a group of people who have never felt safe with police? And I think that's part of the struggle we're in right now. And I see that happening in the city of Seattle, where we're having these conversations everywhere from city hall to classrooms. I mean, even in schools, we're asking ourselves, is it appropriate to have school resource officers, or they're actually Seattle Police Department officers, in middle schools? I don't think it is. And a lot of students are afraid of police officers. So then to go from the street where you're afraid of police officers and then go to school where you're afraid of police officers, we create a context where young people can't learn. And so I do think what we're really thinking about is, you're correct, it's having that goal of dismantling, but also building, redistributing those funds and those resources to something that creates a safer environment for everyone. That's going to require people to begin to see the different ways in which different people are forced to engage law enforcement.
What about the goal of better police instead of fewer police, better trained police, more accountable police?
I hear that argument a lot. And I think it's the way that we go when we're comfortable with incremental reform. When we say over time, we can get a culturally better policing institution. I think reality is people are so comfortable with social control because they are not comfortable with other people. I would rather know that when I am uncomfortable with my neighbor, I can simply just call the cops and the cops will deal with it. And that has some incredibly traumatic outcomes for a lot of people. Think about Seattle as a city that's rapidly gentrifying. A story one of my youth told me is he went home to his house in the Central District. He got into his home with a key. He left, went to a store, and then came back again. And when he came back, the Seattle Police Department was at his house because his neighbor, who just moved into the home next door to him, called the cops on him because she didn't know who he was. Now, this is a young 16-year-old black male. He's been living in that house next to her house almost his entire life. And so her idea of who he was, she had an immediate fear that he didn't belong there. So what she did was call the police, which then ended up in a pretty negative encounter for this young man with the cops, because then he had to explain, actually, this is my home. And it almost amounted in an arrest for him. So when we consider the issue of social control alongside our discomfort with our neighbors and how much we just don't get to know people, I think it actually results in an environment that leads to the sort of murders that we've been seeing. On the flip side of it, I think police are also scared. They're also human beings, right? And I think the policing institution as a whole creates a segment of society where they can be scared, but also then be expected to keep social control. And I think that's a lot of responsibility for an individual human.
So the whole setup is one of, if you think of it, of inhumanity and mistrust.
Absolutely.
We've set ourselves up for that.
We have. We have set ourselves up to dehumanize other humans based on what we consider law enforcement.
When you talk about dismantling the police department with police, current or former, how do they react?
I've spoken with police officers before in different types of situations, sometimes at community meetings. I've been on panels with police officers where we've had this conversation. But also when I serve as a legal observer and in the streets at a protest, I from time to time, I will engage in conversation with officers. I mean, they're human beings, right? And the responses vary. I think it depends on how long they've been in the force, how much they've seen, why they became a police officer. I know someone who became a sheriff, and after being a sheriff for only a year, realized there were just so many egregious violations of people's rights that he was expected to not only participate in, but also keep silent, that he just left the sheriffs because he felt like there was no way he could change it from the inside.
Do you think people in Seattle are especially wedded to police because we're uncomfortable with one another? You talked about a discomfort with our neighbors.
Yeah.
That's not everybody in Seattle, but
yeah.
I've heard that. You've heard the Seattle freeze label.
And I'm from Indiana, so when I first moved here, it was definitely a different world for me. I think as gentrification has taken hold and we see people pushed out of their homes, not just in the Central District, but also in Ballard, I would venture to say people from Ballard have been pushed to the Central District, right? As people get pushed out and moved around, we naturally don't know who's around us. And as humans, as animals, when we don't know who's around us, there's a sense of fear. And I think to get over fear actually requires work. You have to be willing to go get to know the other person. And so I do think that contributes to why we lean so heavily on the policing institution, as opposed to getting to know our neighbors and finding ways to deal with conflict.
So if not police, aren't you talking about basically neighborhood watch groups?
You know, that's a place where I think we have some really complicated conversations we have to have. Neighborhood watch groups in a lot of ways come historically from what we watched the Black Panthers do, which was you had communities of black and brown folks whose interactions with police were continuously problematic. So what we said was we're going to create our own group who will protect us, but also police the police. A lot of what the Black Panthers did was they would actually follow the police around when they saw them stop somebody. They would observe it. They would help people know their rights when interacting with police. And that was in a lot of ways, especially here in Seattle, some of the earliest versions of Neighborhood Watch. When we look at a case like what happened with Trayvon Martin and the vigilante George Zimmerman, we see Neighborhood Watch gone wrong. And I think we've also seen this in Seattle. I went to a Neighborhood Watch meeting with Chief O'Toole. And she was having a conversation with them, I believe it was in West Seattle, of some things that had happened. And the neighborhood watch group was incredibly afraid of the people that they said were coming into their neighborhood. But in a lot of ways, I think this is, again, the result of gentrification. These were actually people who had lived in that neighborhood for a long time, and people didn't know them. So neighborhood watch without a cultural shift is going to result in more incidents of murder, like with Trayvon Martin.
Finally, Nikita, you said yourself, we're not going to walk out of here and dismantle the Seattle Police Department immediately. So what is one thing that you'd like to see happen down that long road? What's next?
You know, I know that the mayor has been proposing 200 more police officers. And a lot of that line for argument has been saying that we have one of the smaller police forces in the United States. I would love to see that the money for those 200 officers actually go towards programs that aim to alleviate poverty, not just simply in the way the city has decided needs to happen, but in a way that's led by the grassroots and those folks who are most pushed to the margins in our society. The one night count for 2016 said we had 4,505 people without a shelter. That's a 19% increase from 2015. And so we know that's a major issue. And yet at the same time, we haven't made any major moves to build housing. And I think as we watch city council and these discussions about new legislation around homeless sweeps, and we hear people come and speak basically about their fear of houseless people, I think the city, being in a state of emergency, has an obligation to respond to help houseless people be safer and to provide the sort of housing that houseless folks say that they want. And that means that when we decide how to spend that money for those 200 officers, houseless folks have to be involved in the conversation in a way that's substantive. Then we'll see the sorts of alleviation of poverty that actually starts preventing crime and starts preventing our need to access law enforcement.
That's Nikita Oliver, a Seattle attorney and anti-racism activist, telling you her vision of a different model of justice, a community-based restorative justice instead of a punitive government police force. And she says that's not going to happen right away. She's looking forward. So what's your vision? What is one way the Puget Sound area could be a better place to live if we would just lift up our heads and think big? Because we would like to hear from you. You can email us at record@kuow.org. record@kuow.org, on the phone, 206-221-3663, 221-3663. Or on Twitter, if you can summarize your big idea in a Twitter-sized package, we are at KUOW. You're listening to The Record. I'm Bill Radke with news to pass on. We're just learning that the investor who wants to build a new sports arena in the Soto neighborhood is now offering to build it all himself with no public financing. Chris Hansen and his investment team say they're willing to build the arena, quote, at no cost to the city or county, end of quote. Hansen's been going back and forth for years with local government over wanting some public financing for a stadium that could bring NBA basketball and NHL hockey to Soto. Now, another sticking point, of course, is that the Port of Seattle doesn't want its freight stuck in more stadium traffic. Hansen's investor group says it would pay what it needs to for an overpass over Lander Street to help industrial traffic move. The question now is, do these proposals clear the final obstacles to a new Seattle sports stadium? We will be answering that question here on KUOW, so stay tuned. Okay, on with KUOW's The Record, and now we're going to talk about Beer College. I know, you think all college is beer college, but this is about a degree in craft brewing. It's a program at Central Washington University. KUOW correspondent Emily Schwing says beer school graduates are in high demand.
Every Wednesday night, students at Central Washington University meet in the school's brewing research lab. Some of them are pursuing a certificate in craft brewing. Others are chasing a full-blown Bachelor of Science degree in the subject.
It smells so nice.
Megan Myers has just learned how to grind grain to the right size in order to maximize what's called efficiency in beer speak.
The size of the grain is really important, because if it's too small, then it's all going to get stuck together in a ball and you won't have the enzymes breaking down the starches like you need to. But if it's too big,
okay.
The sugars aren't exposed.
They're making a sweet liquid called wort from ground-up grain. The next step is to boil it to extract the sugars. Many of these students, like Matt Jacoby, have dabbled in the science of brewing at home.
All I've ever seen is just people doing it online and just kind of learning from what they're doing, but it's all a whole lot of new stuff to me.
Jacoby finished his bachelor's degree in criminal justice 10 years ago, but he enjoyed brewing beer in his kitchen so much that he opted to complete the program's 12 prerequisite classes in chemistry, physics, math, and economics.
This program is great for being able to meet local brewers and local companies that that need people, you know, with an education in how this stuff works.
In fact, program director Steve Wagner says whether students complete a certificate or the bachelor's degree, the school can't meet the market's demand for brewers.
Basically, breweries contact us pretty often looking for students to work at breweries, and we can't fulfill all the placements. This is a really good time to be a craft brewing student and to get jobs.
According to the Brewers Association, there are nearly 4,300 craft breweries operating in the United States, a number that rose 15% between 2014 and 2015 alone. Wagner says it's his personal goal to have a Central Washington graduate working at every brewery in the country. Currently, he says alumni work at 50 of them.
Yeah, actually, we have a lot of students that work as brewers. So the head brewer of No Lie graduated from our program 2 years ago.
Yeah, my name's Ryan Brookhart. I'm the head brewer here at No Lie Brew House.
Brookhart is responsible for 16 beers on tap at No Lie, one of the larger breweries in Spokane. The full-blown degree wasn't offered when he studied craft brewing at Central. He's considered going back just to learn a little more.
You know, anything from mechanical to electrical to plumbing to name it, pretty much.
All the stuff that when you go to the bar and you're actually drinking beer, you never think of.
No, and that's what's great about it. I mean, there's actually a huge amount of work and research, you know, behind all of it.
There are 23 university-affiliated brewing programs in the United States. Two of those are offered in the Northwest, here at Central Washington University, and another at Oregon State University in Corvallis. Back in the brewing research lab, the wort is nearly done. But there's still plenty of work ahead for Megan Myers. She relocated from Brooklyn specifically for this program. Currently, she's pursuing a certificate, but she's hopeful about completing the degree. That could cost between $16,000 and $35,000.
Financially, it's a bit tricky, but as far as having an extra leg up, compared to everyone else who's trying to potentially get a job in a brewery or open their own brewery, I think that it puts us in a really good place.
Good enough to sing about.
Row, row, row your oats, barley too, row two. Sometimes you add rye and wheat. We'll make beer for you. Woo!
In Ellensburg, I'm Emily Schwing reporting.
That was beautiful.
It was good, yeah.
I guess that's the class theme song now.
This is The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke. Now on with more big ideas. If you listen much to KUOW, you know we're working on the homelessness crisis. We're debating what should happen to people without shelter, how they can get housing, where they can sleep in the meantime. Here's an idea from the past. Crosscut columnist Knute Berger is looking back to the Great Depression. He says the Hoovervilles in 1930s and 40s Seattle might help us today. Hoovervilles were not ideal. Seattle's main one was located in what's now SoDo, and this shanty town allowed about 1,500 men of different racial backgrounds to live side by side.
This was a real community, like an urban village. They used to call it a city within a city.
They had built wooden homes?
Yes, they had built shacks, basically.
Shacks.
But they had streets, they had signs, they had a mayor. There were guys who were essentially scrap dealers. They would build these hand carts in Hooverville and go down Seattle's alleys and pick up junk and recycle it. They recycled newspapers, for example. There were others that were fishermen, and they would build a boat or acquire a rowboat and go out in Elliott Bay and fish for their supper. So there was an element of a kind of self-sufficient encampment and this sense that where people could kind of maintain a sense of pride.
And that's important for you today? Is that a part of your thinking?
Well, I don't. They built, with the city's help and patience, were able to build a community that could house people for a decade. And the interesting thing is, if you look at the number of people who were housed in Seattle by Hoovervilles in the 1930s, it was about 4,500 to 5,000 people. Well, that's the number of unsheltered people in King County. You know, when you do the homeless count and the people who aren't in missions and that kind of thing, you're talking about 4,000 to 5,000 people. So the capacity existed in the 1930s to get those people some shelter. And our problem now is, how do you get that many people sheltered as quickly as possible? And it seems to me that looking at Hooverville, looking at the pluses and minuses of it, may suggest scaling up instead of doing things very piecemeal, scaling it up. Maybe we can't get 9 acres in SoDo, but could the city go in for public purpose, condemn property, condemn underutilized industrial space, and provide a larger venue?
We have scattered tent camps. The mayor's authorizing more tent camps. So what's the difference? Aren't we talking about little Hoovervilles?
Yes, my kind of micro Hoovervilles. And there's a good argument for that. But when you scatter people too far, you get people too far from services. You get people too far from whether it's drug treatment or, you know, whatever. There is some advantage to centralizing. And I also think the scale of the problem can be hidden with the scattering, as opposed to finding a way to make it more visible and focus more resources on it. So one of the interesting things to me in the response to my story was how many people of different kinds wrote in with their own idea about how to deal. And it reminds me of sort of where Seattle was back in the 90s with transportation. And everybody was like, oh, we need, this is before, the Sound Transit 2. And people were like, well, we need subways. No, we need gondolas. No, we should have a mosquito fleet. You know, all these different things.
Monorail.
And monorail, exactly. And I got all kinds of people who were writing in saying, you know, we need tiny houses. We need modular housing. And people have, actually were sending me designs of these things and how you could install them inside unused warehouses and that kind of thing. I think it's the problem that's is the back of the envelope thing for people in Seattle. And the question is, how do you move beyond that?
Well, we had this national homelessness expert come to Seattle and tell us to stop opening tent cities. She said they're a distraction from working on real solutions. What is she missing?
Well,
this is the Poppy Report.
Yeah, I think the question is, how do you get people sheltered as quickly as possible on a really large scale while you're doing all the other stuff? So I don't think it's an either-or situation. But I think the fact is we have thousands of people without shelter. Now, the trick and one of the differences between whatever kind of new Hooverville you would build and the old one is accommodating women and children, accommodating families. As you say, the profile of the need and the group is different, or we know more about it. You know, I think we have much more information about who's homeless now than we had in the 1930s.
The irony here is that Hoovervilles came in the Great Depression, and now we're talking about unemployment and the same number of unsheltered people in Seattle's Gilded Age.
Yeah, the solution would be different too, because what you had was a manual labor economy. And the combination of a manual labor economy and mobility, mainly the railroads that emerged in the industrial 1880s. And so suddenly you had this large workforces of manual laborers who could travel anywhere in the country for work. And many of them came here. And we had a problem with vagrants, tramps, hobos, all that, you know, that goes back to the late 19th century in Seattle and the turn of the century and other economic ups and downs. So then you had the Great Depression, which put a lot of people out of work. And what put them back to work was World War II. In 1941, Hooverville went away because the residents of Hooverville, many of them, had jobs. They had jobs both in the shipbuilding and Boeing and whatever. They were also able to take the jobs of younger men who went off to fight. So the sort of temporary solution of Hooverville. Now we have an economy, an economic situation where you're creating a large number of sort of dispossessed people due to the economic inequalities that are built into growth and to the boom. And so, you know, that is a big issue that can only be addressed at the macro level.
A modern Hooverville, Knud, are you talking about creating a slum?
Well, that's what some critics suggest would be the outcome. And there's evidence that that kind of thing could be true. I mean, cities all over the world that are rapidly urbanizing are also dealing with large numbers of people who can't be housed. And so they build these large shanty communities, favelas, whatever you want to call them, that become sprawling parts of the metropolis. I think some people would worry if you built a couple of big Hoovervilles that they would be permanent in the sense that. And there are a couple ways to look at that. One is that, no, they would be, you would have robust infrastructure for them. And maintenance of them, and they would be, you know, temporary facilities, but not temporary like 1 year. They would be, you know, a decade or whatever, while you built the other kinds of housing that could then integrate the population more thoroughly into the general community. The other thing is, you know, the United Nations and others are working at how to convert slum areas to, you know, better served, more, you know, neighborhoods that are more integrated with the cities that they're associated with. And so I think that there are ways that you could potentially even turn a Hooverville into a permanent neighborhood. And, you know, it might take, you know, a lot of private and public funding and other things, but it actually might be part of the permanent answer. It would just depend on how you handled it.
Does the city have that kind of public land?
Well, my suggestion is that they could condemn land for public purpose and acquire it. And it would be expensive. There's no question about that. But I think the getting on top of the problem in terms of getting people more rapidly housed or sheltered, it's a big problem. And I think there's a way it needs to be dealt with in a fairly dramatic way, as opposed to just dealing with it in the incremental way.
Is the city listening? Is a modern Hooverville going to happen?
Well, you know, I did get email from city council members who felt like they're working on aspects of what I was talking about. And I think a lot of people in this city are, you know, trying to solve this problem. One of the issues is scale funding, of course. The city itself has got, you know, a bunch of recommendations that they're going to implement. The mayor has a plan. So my feeling is that it's all good. I think history kind of can help inform, like, you know, how did we deal with this before? And yeah, the conditions are different, but some of them are eerily the same.
Knud Berger writes the Mossback column at crosscut.com, this one about how Hooverville-type shanty towns could be an answer for the unsheltered people of Seattle and King County. We're tweeting out a link to his story right now at KUOW. Now, while you're thinking about how to shelter people in Seattle, let's meet a couple of the people who are leaving this town.
All the artists should come with us to Tucson. They're not using us here, so let's go.
That's costume designer and artist Mark Mitchell. He's lived and worked in Seattle for 30 years. His partner, Kurt B. Riley's been DJing on KEXP and elsewhere and writing about music, but this winter, they're leaving. As Mark said, moving to Tucson. Mark says when he moved here 32 years ago, Capitol Hill was a great place for him to be as a gay man.
It was great to be around gay people and be around a lot of gay people, especially with what was happening in the world at that time as regards AIDS. I wanted to be around gay people. I didn't want to be around straight people and have to deal with their issues around AIDS. We had our own stuff to deal with. So for me, it was really a blessing to be able to be in a place like that and be sort of sheltered by that community and be a part of that community. And now, of course, what's happened is that the Hill has changed so drastically, and just because of, I think, of assimilation and the forward strides we've made in a lot of ways, we don't have that need for a concentrated gay neighborhood the way that we once did. And I think we lose a lot with that. As an old queen, I say we lose we lose a lot whenever we lose an older generation, and we lost so many. So that's all tied up together for me, and part of the reason that makes it kind of easy to leave now.
Well, Mark, you're a known artist in this city. Kurt, you've been a DJ for KEXP. Why would you leave the city whose culture you helped create? Thanks a lot.
Myriad reasons. It's you, Bill. I'm leaving because of you. No, it's not because of you. I'm actually sad to leave a lot of amazing people. But Seattle's not the only place I lived. So I've always been confident that you can take the show on the road, and it's actually good to every now and then, because it forces you to reassess your own strengths and weaknesses and get in touch with who you are and who you can be in your community.
So it's just time to ramble on, or is there something about Seattle that you can't wait to leave?
There are a couple of specifics. For us, really, we simply couldn't afford to live here anymore. We lost two homes in 2 years. The first one wiped out any nest egg that we have. And the second one, I said to myself, if I have to hustle this hard to find us another place to live, I'll be damned if I'm throwing the dice in Seattle.
We looked at a future here that was just, we would never be able to afford. I mean, I'm an artist, okay? So our income is a little crazy, but to be that much at risk, where we can look at a city like Tucson, where the housing costs are like half of what they of what they are here, we're going to.
Why don't you move to a cheaper suburb, Shoreline, SeaTac,
and drive all day? No,
Angle Lake Light Rail Station.
I didn't move here for that. I didn't move here to live out somewhere. I moved here to live in Seattle, and so that part's done for me. I'm ready for a new adventure.
Why Tucson?
If you've ever spent time in the desert is an incredibly magical place. Equally magical is the Northwest, but the desert speaks to me in a way that the Northwest never has. I went to college in Tempe, Arizona, so I was in the desert for about 5 years, and I felt more at home there just environmentally than I have ever anywhere.
Mark, how's your look going to go over in Tucson? You are rocking some remarkable
everywhere I go.
Yeah, the tattoos, the earrings, the nose ring, the fabulous glasses. How's that play in Tucson?
How does it play in Seattle? I get as many weird looks here as I've gotten anywhere else in the country.
Is that right?
I mean, I feel comfortable around. I feel comfortable in who I am, so I don't really notice anymore. I've been getting side eye from people since I was a kid, so it doesn't even affect me. I take it as a compliment more than anything. I don't really worry about what other people think about the way I look.
Seattle versus Tucson, what are the trade-offs? What do you lose? What do you gain?
I am going to lose, I hope, some of the lingering depression and respiratory problems I've been having here. I've had
a little moist for you?
It's been a little moist, and it's funny. When I moved here from New York, I remember a neighbor in my building asking, I didn't know her well. She's like, where are you moving? And I'm like, Seattle. And she's like, oh, I moved there for 8 years and the rain finally got to me. And for the longest time, I loved the rain, loved it. And I know I will miss the gentle rain of Seattle, but the last couple of winters have just been too hard for me. It's just been too much with work and the dark and the wet and not feeling well. It was grinding me down.
That's how we stay a youthful city. People can only take the rain so long, and then you go to Arizona.
You know what? Right. Everyone in Tucson carries a water bottle. I'm a homosexual. I know how to moisturize. But I really will miss the network of people that I've built here. I'm excited to create a new network. I'm excited to be the new kid on the block, and I'm really looking forward to diving into Tucson's music scene and meeting people and exploring its clubs and seeking out the opportunities. But I'll be doing that from a position of, you know, innocence and inexperience. I won't have the same advantages, and there are definitely pluses and minuses to that.
Should everyone leave Seattle?
Absolutely not.
Well, I don't mean everyone
I was
at
say
once.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
No, I'm just kidding. Everyone.
But I mean, should anyone, I don't mean should the city empty. I mean, should everybody get out of their comfort zone and leave Seattle at some point?
Oh, for sure. I mean, well, I've never been a huge traveler. I mean, I've mostly of the last 30 years in Seattle, I've been in Seattle. I've traveled very little. And now I'm starting to expand that and starting to travel a bit. And boy, it's blown my mind. So, I mean, it's good for everybody to get out of their comfort zone, for sure.
I know that for musicians in particular, it's really easy to achieve a certain level of status in Seattle. And I'm proud that KEXP and The Stranger and lots of organizations I've played a part in contribute to that. But I really admire the musicians that use that as a jumping off point and get in the van and go tour the country and try to get involved with activities outside of their city. Because I really do think that taking your show on the road, no matter what your discipline, is the biggest test of your mettle.
What is your parting message to Seattle? What do you want us to do differently? We're listening.
Take care of the next generation of artists. I feel that it's too late for a lot of people in our bracket, you know, people who have been here 15, 20, 25 years.
You don't want to lose any more artists than we have. We lost Eric Blood last month.
We lost Larry Mizell Jr.
We lost Larry Mizell. I mean, it's just so Seattle seems to be hemorrhaging artists now because it's so expensive to stay here and there's not studio space.
So what would taking care of artists look like?
I'm not entirely sure. But making sure that there is affordable housing. I would love to see some sort of rent control. I don't think we're ever going to. But making sure that there's more affordable housing, that there are decent wages for people.
We just passed a higher minimum wage and affordable housing levy.
Yep. It's a bit late.
A little late.
It's late. I mean, even if we wanted to stay here, where on earth are we going to find a place between now and December 1st that we can afford, that we're going to have some kind of security in? I mean, landlords here give you a one-year lease like it's a big deal. You know what I mean? People can't pick up and move unless you live out of a suitcase. That's fine when you're young, maybe. But it looked grim. Mm-hmm. The future looked grim.
What's your parting message, Boo?
Thank you for all the great times and all the crazy times and all the horrible times and all the wonderful recognition, because I've really been spoiled in the last few years with really great recognition from Seattle. And so I do leave here really loving this place and loving so many people here.
Kurt and Mark, happy trails. We'll miss you. Thank you for all the work you did here. And thanks for coming in and saying goodbye.
Well, thanks to Seattle and thank you, Bill. It was a pleasure to talk about it before we go.
Kurt B. Riley, a.k.a. DJ El Toro on KEXP, along with Mark Mitchell. Mark's an artist and a costume designer, and they're splitting for Tucson after about 30 years in Seattle and telling you, take care of your artists. Are you planning to leave the Puget Sound area? Because we would like to talk to you before you leave. Tell us why you're going, what will you miss, what will you gain, and what's your final message to the Seattle area? What can we do better? Email us at record@kuow.org and tell us why you're quitting us. record@kuow.org. KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Now we're going to talk about the Gateway Painting. I think I was a fifth grader, I did my big report on Vincent van Gogh. In high school, I sang Starry, Starry Night, paint your palette blue and gray. In college, I had those swirling stars on my wall. Now here's our book expert, Nancy Pearl, telling Marcy Silman about a gift for kids and parents who want to know more about art.
It's called Vincent Starry Night and Other Stories, A Children's History of Art, written by Michael Bird. And illustrated, and we have to talk about the illustrator because, like the best children's books, the illustrator and the writer work together, and the illustrator is Kate Evans.
Well, what's really great is when you see the book, the cover, it is called Vincent Starry Night, and what we see is, I assume then, Kate Evans' take on that iconic Van Gogh painting.
Yes, and we see Van Gogh painting the painting, and then the background is his Starry Night. So this is really a history of art. And as someone who taught art history many years ago, I wish this book had junior college students. I wish this book had been around then, because it's just pretty great. We're also talking about the need for diverse books that would, you know, the thing about libraries is that children need to find themselves in the pages of a book, and they need to lose themselves in the pages of the book. That's the wonderful, wonderful way. That's the way I love thinking about it. So this is a book that is not only the great European masters. This is a book that begins 40,000 years ago with the cave painters.
Oh, my.
Includes of course African artists, Ai Weiwei.
Ai Weiwei is a Chinese
artist. Frida Kahlo, the medieval European artists. And these are stories about them with reproductions of their typical work, and then these wonderful illustrations by Kate Evans showing them at work.
So stories meaning a story about the person's life.
A story about an incident in a person's life. You know, there's dialogue. These are not things that we know happened, but the dialogue about the artist or about his or her work.
Who is Michael Bird, the author?
Michael Bird, that's so interesting. He's a writer and an art historian and a radio broadcaster. Again, I had never heard of him. I picked this book up because, like you, I was drawn to the cover. It's hard not to want to open up the book and see what's in there. And what's in there, I think, gives young people and the adults who love them a wonderful picture, a snapshot of these artists, where you can then say, oh, I love what they did. I love this story. Let me go find more about them. You know, Vasari's Lives of the Painters and Artists, written a long time ago. Vasari loved gossip. And in that book, I mean, that his account of those artists that we think of, you know, they're the iconic Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci. I mean, he's just telling stories about them, and they're great fun to read.
But doesn't that make you then want to go back and look at their artwork?
Oh, totally. It gives you an insight into who those people really were, in a way that someone who is analyzing the art, there's a place for that, of course, but I think for the general reader who wants to appreciate or wants to learn about or be introduced to different artists, that the way Michael Bird and Kate Evans have done it in this book is the way to go.
I might need to walk over to the university bookstore. The book is Vincent's Starry Night and Other Stories, A Children's History of Art. It was written by Michael Bird, illustrated by Kate Evans, and Nancy recommends it for kids 8 and older. She talked with KUOW's arts and culture reporter Marcy Silman, and you'll find all of Nancy's book picks at KUOW.org. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in today to KUOW's The Record.